longer and re-summarize what I said. I hope to add some additional information so it's not entirely repeated information. The quote I chose for Anne Bradstreet is a quote that she devotes to her husband. If ever two were one, then surely we. If ever man were loved by wife, then thee. This shows a very, very personal and intimate point in Anne Bradstreet's life. And what we're going to see in Anne Bradstreet is the first female poet in America. When I published the notes, I wrote in brackets the first poet published in America, because actually there weren't that many things going on in America in terms of literature. Most of the writings were the type of writings that we've seen from William Bradford, in this case in the Massachusetts colony. In the Massachusetts colony, Anne Bradstreet's father is going to be one of the governors, and Bradstreet's husband is going to be another one of the governors. So last week we were talking about the connection of Puritans with power. And this is a perfect example of how directly connected Puritans are going to be to the centers of power. They're going to be the preachers. They're going to control the churches. They're going to control, from that point of controlling the churches, they're going to control the universities. And they're going to control the centers of power. They're going to be the governors. They're going to be the people in charge of managing these colonies that are highly driven by religion in these first 100 years or so of the existence of the colonies, especially the colonies that were overloaded with Puritans coming from England in droves to avoid the religious persecution that we were talking about during the first units. In the case of Anne Bradstreet, we have a daughter that is brought aboard a boat called the Arbella to America, and therefore she is an English citizen that is a settler in the Newfoundland. She abides to the Puritan principles, and one of the paradoxes that we're going to have at the beginning of the course, and we're going to have to look for an explanation, is if everything is so centered about in religion, why from the first three authors that we see and that have to do with Puritanism, William Bradford, Anne Bradstreet, and Mary Rowlandson, why are two of them women? The role that was limited to women was very, very specific. Women were expected in Puritan culture to not grant any importance to education, and to grant importance to bringing up a family and marrying well. That idea of marrying well was key and center to Puritan culture, because either you married well or you ran out of opportunities. This is not something that is only from this century. Whoever's read Jane Austen, for example, knows that that is exactly the problem that English society had. There were a ton of possibilities allotted to men, and there was only one possibility allotted to women, which was to marry well or to suffer the consequences. In the cases that we're going to see in this course, we're going to see the importance of marriage as a deciding factor only in the case of women. In the case of men, it's never going to be a factor. It's a non-factor. We're never going to talk about the marriage of our male authors, except in terms to compare the importance of their wives in their work, to maybe talk about some anecdote that is connected to how they started to write, things like that. But in the case of female writers, their marital status is paramount. It's fundamental for understanding the author. In this case, Anne Bradstreet was married to a powerful man, proceeded from a powerful family. Her father was governor of the Massachusetts colony. Her husband succeeded her father as governor of the Massachusetts colony, and she had 8 children. The oddity in the case of Anne Bradstreet was that she wrote poems for the delight of her family. Something that there's always going to be, if we have to use one word to define Anne Bradstreet, it's that of paradox. It's the conflict between what is the expectations of a Puritan wife and a Puritan mother, and what is the reality of her life. It was not well seen for a woman to write, and it was less well seen for a woman to publish. So how did her work see the light? Her work was published ultimately because, according to the common understanding, her brother-in-law took the poems from her and published them without her consent, without her explicit permission, in London. And she was celebrated as a poet that had, in the title of the book, it says that had sprung up in America, and that is the title of her book of poems. First, there was a collection of poems that was published without her consent, and afterwards, that set of poems was reviewed and extended, and her work was the core of her work that has reached our time is the revised edition of her work. Her poetry is very important because it follows all the standard, all the classical standards, all the neoclassical standards of the time. She relies heavily on her readings of Sidney and Spencer. She relies heavily on how well she understood and read the classics. And therefore we have an evolution of the poetry of the time, but from the perspective of a woman, which is very important because it defined her choice of topic, her perspective, the way that she confronted problems, and all of this with a massive Puritan overtone to her poetry. So we're going to have to match these two realities of how can this Puritan society that is so conservative and has such a limited role for women accept that one of their own is publishing and is writing with metaphors that sound so distant from a didactic purpose and from the Puritan plain style, which are the two key elements of Puritan writing. How can we connect that to the idea that her poems were fairly successful and she had the opportunity of even revising and extending them? We're going to see how she tries to confront that dilemma, and whether she's successful or not is something that you'll have to evaluate on your own. I was telling the students before we started recording, and maybe some of you have come to the class afterwards, or you're watching this as a recording, that Anne Bradstreet is the perfect author to learn about poetry. If poetry is something that has always been a problem, that has been intimidating, that it instills fear when you have to confront it, Anne Bradstreet is sufficiently, her poetry is sufficiently simple and well-structured and abiding to classical standards, that it is perfect training ground for learning the theory that you should know for sure, not only for this poet, but for all the poets that you have to analyze. I know that in Ejes, or whatever the name of the subject is of English literature, it was called different when I was a student, you have to read a lot of poetry, and you're already expected to know, or you have the feeling that you're expected to know how to analyze that poetry. So these poems are very interesting because nothing is taken for granted, and there is a very solid reference in the study guide, especially in the study guide, but also in the course book that can help you understand the poems, and that's what we're going to do, because this is a problem that I face every year. I face students that are basically a bit scared of talking about poetry because they want to sound as prepared as when they talk about prose, and that seems to be their comfort zone, seems to be prose, but not seems to be poetry in the majority of the cases. Now, before we continue, I'm going to read from this book that I normally bring to class, Puritanism to Postmodernism, a very brief introduction of the importance of Ann Bradstreet in the global scheme of things. And this is information that is partially collected in the textbook, but I think it helps you to have like a better global view, and that's why I normally read from this book a few paragraphs every day. An author that is the first major woman poet in English language is Ann Bradstreet. Born in England, she sailed in 1630 on the Arbella. Both her father and her husband, by whom she had 8 children, were governors of Massachusetts Bay. But it is partly because the poetry she produced between domestic duties and recurring bouts of illness is not about great political, historical, or theological matters that she interests us. She didn't talk about the times that she lived. It's a bit like when you read Jane Austen. There's a certain timelessness to her work because she never deals with current affairs. She just leaves that in the background, and maybe there's a war, maybe there's some soldiers going to war. You don't even know what war it is. You're just focused on the events. From the poet's point of view, all of her poetry is about her inner world, this family world, this community world. And that's a bit what Puritans were. They were their community. They were only worried. They were pretty self-centered in their community, in their reality, in their lifestyle. So the other factor that is surprising about Ann Bradstreet is that she reached a very significant age for the time, something that was out of the ordinary. She lived to the age of 60. So that means that she outlived several of her children and several of her grandchildren. You can understand how painful it is for a mother to lose a son or a daughter. You can even imagine how painful it is for a grandmother to lose a grandson or a granddaughter. So part of her work is going to be about how she deals with that pain and how she finds explanations to the death of innocent children, which is a very, very important element. We're going to analyze 4 poems. The author to her book, which is an extremely clear case of apostrophe. What is apostrophe? Let me read from the study guide what apostrophe is. In the study guide, you have an excellent glossary at the end. That means it's a list of terminology. Apostrophe in the A says a figure of speech in which an animal, a thing, a place, an abstract quality, an idea, or a dead or absent person is addressed as if present and capable of understanding. So what does she do in these poems? She writes to her poems. She writes a poem about the poems. So this is like the mother of all apostrophes. She's writing to her book of poems, and she's writing it from a mockingly apologetic tone. There's always going to be, in female writing, during these first centuries, a sense of apologetic writing, like looking for a good explanation for writing, being a woman, which is something that a man would never do. Men felt empowered to write, but women, far from being empowered, had to sort of apologize or look for a good explanation of why they were writing in the first place. So the author to her book is a poem from the revised edition that was published. I don't know if I have the exact date of the revised version. Yes, 1678. So her first collection of poems was published in 1650. You see how we've progressed in time over the first 3 units. 1608 is the first writing by Captain John Smith. Afterwards, he wrote in 1616, 1624. He published three works of importance. In 1630, we read about We learned about William Bradford's of Plymouth Plantation, and we move forward 20 years all the way to 1650 for the work that her brother-in-law decided to call the 10th Muse, lately sprung up in America. And there is there are some other adjectives added later to the title that we'll talk about. In 1678, she wrote a revised edition. From that revised edition, the first poem that we're going to read is from that revised edition. So take into consideration that there is no chronological order in this set of poems. The selection of poems is based on the importance they have in order to understand poetry in the first case and Anne Bradstreet's poetry in the second case. So that's why these poems are selected in particular. The author took her book, which is this example of apostrophe, to my dear and loving husband, which is a sort of love letter / love poem to her husband, which is very, very unusual. Upon the burning of our house, on my dear grandchild Simon Bradstreet. Okay, so those four poems are the poems that we're going to analyze. We're going to counterpose neoclassical poetry with Puritan aesthetics, how they match or how they collide, and how she managed to fit this ornamented English Renaissance style that is rich with metaphors and symbols into the Puritan plain style framework. How does that work? So the next point that we're going to talk about, and it's another objective of this unit, is to examine these tensions between Bradstreet's public and private voice. Her public voice is very clear, the poems. Her private voice, what you read in between the lines in poems. And for this unit, it's very important to know how to read between the lines. But in the case of the next poem that we're going to analyze, Phyllis Wheatley, it's absolutely fundamental to analyze that private voice, that subversive tone that she has underlying the plain text. So you have the plain text on one hand, and then you have this extra reading, this close analysis that leads you to a different conclusion, that there's a certain subversive tone. Every time we read about women, we're going to come to that conclusion that they are pioneers or trailblazers, but at the same time they're subversive because they're breaking the rules. Women are not supposed to write. It's not well seen for women to write. In the slides you posted, it says she was a non-separatist Puritan. What does that mean? Non-separatist Puritans were the Puritans that did not want to break with the Church of England, but they wanted to reform it. That's what the non-separatist Puritan means. It's just a specific part of Puritanism. Remember that anyway, Julio, that we're having a huge amount of people traveling year after year to the English colonies. They're becoming more prosperous. They're becoming more of a reality. And therefore, we're going to get all kinds of religions mixed and mingled. But remember what I said in the last class. What is considered the official seed of the American sentiment, of the American dream, of the manifest destiny, I've seen very interesting conversations in the forums. I don't know if you read the forums, but it is completely my recommendation to read them, to actively participate. If the general forums seem too big or too complicated or maybe you feel a bit intimidated, write in ours. Just write your answer to any exploratory question. Go to one that you find easy to tackle and try to provide your answer. And let's see if we start a discussion. That's a delight when some of these classes, when you get together and you have a conversation, that's when you really learn, because you start to ask yourself different questions. Going back to Julio's question, the amount of religious people that are going to go to America are not only going to be Puritans, in this case, non-separatist Puritans, which were probably the less threatening for the English crown and probably the less persecuted, but other kinds of religion, separatist Puritans, Puritans that wanted to break away with everything, and other religions that were not purely Calvinist, like, for example, Quakers or other religions. Right now, it's probably one of the only places in the world, the East Coast of America, some areas of Pennsylvania, some areas of Virginia, some areas of Massachusetts, where you can still see people that live in a very, very similar way to how their great-great-great-great-grandparents lived. The Quakers are the most common case that we see on television. There are still hundreds of them, if not thousands. And what that represents is the same type of religious life and life that had to do with hard work and with having God at the center of all of their activities that we see in Puritan culture. In Puritan culture, everything revolves around the idea of religion. Okay, so everything that she writes has to have that point of religion at the forefront, because everything that Puritans do, they do for God. They don't do for themselves. They don't do for their family. They don't do for anyone. So from a point of view of our current perspective, our current mentality, that kind of life can seem sad or can seem unfulfilling, because people were not living to make one another happy. They were living to be worthy of God's grant of reaching heaven. I don't know, Julio, if I addressed your question. If you have any other further questions, just let it rip in the chat. It's great to have your interaction. That way, I know that there's not a technical problem. Okay. Well, the other thing that we're going to do, and we're probably going to do this before we get into detail with the poems, is learn about the basics about English metrical pattern generally used in early American poetry. Something that you have to take into consideration is that American poetry tends to be simplistic at first. American literature tends to be simplistic at first, because everything that comes from America is a repetition of patterns that come from England. There is a sense of replicating another literature, and that is something that happens in all foreign literatures before they find their own identity. It is not until the turn of the 18th century to the 19th century that we're going to see something that is authentically American. Over the course of the American Revolution and the years that lead up to the 19th century, to the beginning of the 19th century, is when America starts to have its own, not only independent country, but independent voice. And that independent voice comes with a unique choice of topics, a unique way of expressing ideas, and that is going to come over time. So it's an element that takes time to develop, and therefore, from the perspective of the English reader, everything that came from America was either unsurprising or it was okay for being American. That was the general sentiment of a superiority complex that is going to last until the mid-19th century push of American literature is so strong that it becomes one of the most influential literatures in the world. And that's when it finds a voice of its own, and it doesn't have that complex anymore. But we're going to see, as a recurring theme in Benjamin Franklin, in James Fenimore Cooper, in Washington Irving, how the search for the American voice, for the Americanness, is something that is a very important topic. For these initial Puritans, they couldn't care less, because they were only worried about their Puritan world, their group of Puritans, their small reducted circle of followers. Moving on to the next slide. Just a summary of her biography. Well, this is a bit slow now. We're going to focus on some specifics that I would like you to walk away understanding what they mean. My aspiration is for you to learn all of them, but if at least I would love you to walk away with a solid idea of most of them. Extended metaphor, pun, tone, verbal irony, anaphora, allusion, imagery, paradox, elegy, apostrophe, ambiguity, ambivalence, pathos, theme, atmosphere, and figurative language. Understanding the intricate difficulties of in this unit due to dealing with poetry, what I said from the get-go, and analyzing the poem itself, the foot, what is a caesura, if it rhymes or it doesn't rhyme, and what is the importance of rhyme, free verse, I rhyme, stanza, all of these concepts, for you to start to shake away the fear of understanding all these topics. That's my objective for this unit. I would want nothing else than for you to feel that you can approach poetry with more confidence than before. Going back to the introductory book that I normally use, just a couple of lines more. For today's women writers, she represents a crucial antecedent. She's considered the grandmother of poetry. She acquired a contemporary reputation as the first author of a volume of American poems. Her brother-in-law published her work in London in 1650, apparently without her knowledge, as a 10th muse lately sprung up in America. Compiled and added the title, with great variety of wit and learning, full of delight. Puritan titles seem to not be able to condense the idea. They just go on and on for two or three lines, and they don't have any problems with writing long titles. These high claims were doubtless not her own, for her own note is essentially more restrained. The Puritan woman is going to be a restrained woman that is not willing to air her thoughts and is normally going to be very private. It's not well seen to be openly enthusiastic about being a poet. And she's always going to confront the problems of being a poet. I could continue reading because there's a lot of interesting nuance in this book, but I think that with that initial introduction, it would be enough for the moment. Her poems receive recognition both back in England and in the New World. So she is immediately celebrated as a poet of a certain talent. Okay? Move on to the next slide. Regarding her biography, very quickly, she was born and educated in London. Her father was a steward of the Earl of Lincoln. And that is a key point that explains her education. She received a considerable education. There's a typo there. Obviously, it's a considerable education. Far beyond the average of the women of her time. She benefited from the huge libraries and tutors of the Earl. She lived to the age of 60, seeing all her 8 children grow to adult age. She married in 1630, and she moved to Massachusetts Bay Colony. She was a non-separatist Puritan. That's what Julio Neira was asking about. She suffered from ill health most of her life. She often felt the threat of death, especially when she was close to childbirth. So there is an idea of imminent death whenever she had to give birth, which is something that we can relate to, knowing how difficult delivering was at the time and how much medicine has advanced from then. It was not uncommon for women to die during childbirth, and she had 8 children, so that increased her possibilities of dying even further. She is currently considered the grandmother of American poetry. Hers was the first published book of poems by an inhabitant of America. Hers was probably also the first book in American literature to be published by a woman. Her book was published without her knowing. We already talked about it. She afterwards revised it, adding a considerable number of new poems. So the revised edition, the 1678 edition, has so many new poems that it can be considered a completely different book, because of all of the work that is included. She wrote the preface poem, the author to her book. We've heard about it. We're going to read it. And it was published, unfortunately, 6 years after her death, which it might sound outrageous, but it's going to be very common in this course. You should get used to this posthumous publishing because it happens all the time. The complete name of the 1678 revised version is called Several Poems Compiled with Great Variety of Wit and Learning. And that's where there is a certain point of, first of all, she alludes, referring to herself. So she's alluding the fact that she's a woman, or she's at least concealing it as much as possible. For over two centuries, she was not considered a major author. She was eliminated from any canon status because her poems were considered simplistic, copies of poems that were already being published in England. And it was only in the 20th century, only with the rise, for example, of feminism, that she became well known again. This is going to happen recurrently with female writers. And it is thanks to the revisionism of the second half of the 20th century that her work has reached us with this canonical status where she is considered one of the great authors of early American literature. Her independence and integrity that she clearly has in her poems collide in a difficult way to match her religious principles of duty and inner feeling. There are times where you can see cracks or crevices or wrinkles in her faith, and you can see how at the end of every poem there is an undeterring return to her Puritan faith, and there's like a happy Puritan ending. She returns to faith in every poem. There is not a single tragedy in her life or circumstance that makes her lose her faith completely. She may have moments of despair, but she finds her way inside the poem of returning to the gratefulness for the divine providence and her image of a God that is more knowledgeable than she is. So we're going to have to analyze this conflict between her public voice that tends to imitation, the apparent structure of the poem, and the private voice that is more original, more unique. And in every poem that we analyze, we're going to see elements that make her poetry more unique. Her poetical style has to do with Puritan aesthetics, no matter what. Even though it seems an unrepairable paradigm to write poetry and be a Puritan, she manages to follow Puritan principles and Puritan aesthetics in her poetry. She does feel that she follows a Puritan plain style, and that's why her poems are considered simplistic by critics of the time. And she is at the same time influenced by the ornamental style of the time in poets. I talked about that before. I don't know if I was recording. Spencer, Sidney, Sir Walter Raleigh, and the French Calvinist poem Guillaume de Beauvoir, which she considers her literary godfather, the person that gives her a bigger influence or provides a bigger influence, because thanks to being able to experience a Calvinist poet of her time, it provides her with sufficient moral background to say, if Guillaume de Beauvoir can write, so can I, even though I'm a Puritan. Because remember that Puritanism is a sort of Calvinism. It's not a separate movement. Puritanism is considered to be a subtype of Calvinism. Calvinism being more general and Puritanism being more specific. Okay? We talked about the Puritan principles in William Bradford. Have a look at how they followed specifically a close reading of a certain passage of the Bible. She was also inspired by the English metaphysical poets, not post. We're going to see that this happens also in the case of Emily Dickinson, so it brings us a connection there. And her writing and literary style seems to be or is contradictory to theoretical Puritan condemnation of figurative language. And that's a contradiction that she's going to have to face during her lifetime. Yes, with the ornamental style of the Renaissance tradition, she follows the style of verse. For example, the length of the quatrains, the choice of words that was popular in the Renaissance. But at the same time, she tries to have an underlying Puritan framework. So she's trying to do something very difficult. She's trying to write in a Puritan plain style with a didactic purpose, and at the same time try to do the same poetry that other authors were doing with a completely different mindset. Sorry. Okay, great. No, I mean, the didactic purpose is much clearer in William Bradford. What is the didactic purpose of a poem? What are you going to teach further generations? Well, yes, and that's where, thanks to the French Calvinist poet Barthes, she finds a crack in the system or a way of expressing herself through poetry that still follows Puritan principles. If Barthes can do it, so can she. That's her mindset. But as I said, completely different to the mindset that other authors of the time had. On page 26 of the study guide, you have a point where it's going to say, study unit 3, studying unit 3 is certainly the most challenging in American literature to the 1900 for several reasons. It is the first one to deal with poetry, a literary genre which is open to a wide range of appreciations because its essence remains elusive, its nature mysterious, and its substance unfathomable. Reading good poetry is gratifying, but it may also be more demanding than prose, especially in the case of 17th century poetry. Moreover, the 17th century poems you will find in this unit have been kept in their original form without modernizing their spelling and punctuation, unlike the prose text of the same period which you have examined so far. As a result, you should reasonably expect to devote to this particular unit more time and energy than to any other one in the textbook, perhaps as much as you have already spent on the two previous units together. So it's really scaring you. Due to the specific difficulties which might rise, you will receive plenty of practical assistance. And that's where we're going for. So in the next paragraph, it gives the key to understanding poetry in English. In order to understand the halfway through the paragraph, in order to understand the fundamentals of verse form, you need to work out stress patterns for yourself. Stress is an additional loudness or length or voice intensity. The syllables which carry stress are called stress, and those which do not carry stress are called unstressed. To get practice, there you have some ideas of where the stress is. Okay, so you would get locking, first syllable, first syllable, forgetting, second syllable. That would give you a pattern of how things words are divided into stressed or unstressed syllables. When we read Spanish poetry, we normally analyze the amount of syllables. In English poetry, however, especially in classic English poetry, what we do is we take syllables two by two. And those two by two, we see how they are stressed. So the stress is as important as a rhyme. The stress is going to give us one type of stress pattern, an iamb, which is the most common form of stress pattern, or the troik. You can see, in point number three, it says that the iamb is one unstressed syllable followed by a stressed one. For example, away is going to be the most common pattern in English literature, especially in this classical English literature. Sorry, poetry. The trochee is the opposite. It's one stressed syllable followed by an unstressed one. Lovely. Okay? The anapest is two unstressed syllables followed by a stressed one. This is common in Spanish literature, but however, the iamb and the trochee are not as common in Spanish poetry or in Spanish literature. Remember that when we speak in Spanish, words tend to be longer, and stressing syllables beyond the two last syllables is much more common in Spanish than it is in English. So it does make sense that the iamb and the trochee are the dominant figure in poetry for a very long time. So what we're going to have are iambic meters. What type of iambic meters? The syllables are connected by two or three syllables into what is called the foot. You have the foot on page 28. So a tetrameter are 4 feet. That means that it has 8 syllables. Okay? If it's an iamb or a trochee, a pentameter has 5 feet. An iambic pentameter, which is the most classical Renaissance pattern, is 5 feet of iambs. All of them are iambs, so it's da 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 da. So you have the feeling of experiencing something that has like a certain musicality in it. Okay, so that's one of the elements that you have to take into consideration. Some of the students are coming and going. I don't know if you have any connection problems. I hope that the audio is fine. Maybe you can write down if the audio experience and the video experience are working so far. Something that we have to take into consideration is the caesura. I'm going to go back to the list where I was talking about this, so you can cross that off in the amount of things that you have information about. So far, we've talked about stress, we've talked about the syllables, we've talked about the feet, the foot of the poem, and we've talked about the type of feet that we are going to recognize. Basically, in this unit, iambs or trochees, and the natural length or the most popular length of verses. tetrameters, pentameters, heptameters, octameters. Remember that for Spanish poetry standards, you would have to multiply all of that by two. Tetrameter would be octasyllable. A pentameter would be decasyllable. If you remember studying Renaissance poetry in Spanish, you might remember that endecasílabos were probably the most popular in Spanish and French and Italian poetry. But in English poetry, the pentameter is the standard. The pentameter is the golden standard that everybody is following at the time. I thought I had a list there. Let me see if the slide wants to change. Okay, yes. Foot, caesura, rhyme, free verse, I rhyme, stanza. Caesura would be a pause inserted anywhere inside a metrical line. So it would be like an artificial pause inside a poem. For example, in Anne Bradstreet's poem about her house burning, she says, "Farewell my pelf, farewell my store." So there is a comma there, and there is a implicit caesura. In another one, in the other one where she talks about one of her deceased relatives, she says, "Go pretty babe, go rest with sisters twain." So that means that other children have also died in childbirth before her. There is a caesura there. The caesura can divide the poem into two equal parts, or it can divide the poem into one part that is bigger than the other, or more significantly size than the other. Not all poets choose to use fixed meter pattern. In free verse that we're going to study in the second semester, departs from this idea of being constrained by meter and by rhyme. Meter and rhyme is going to be something that is dated, and it's very relevant at the beginning of American literature, but it's going to lose its favor in favor of a non-rhyming scheme in free verse. So rhyming and meter are both going to be consecutively discarded over time. But we'll get there. We'll get there. For the moment, everything rhymes very well. Sometimes we have exact rhymes. We have perfect rhymes or full rhymes where we say, for example, cat, bat, hat, fat, something like that. And sometimes we have para rhymes or partial rhymes or imperfect rhymes or half rhymes or slant rhymes, like room and storm. Sometimes it depends on how we pronounce words now and how they were pronounced in the 17th century. Maybe storm was pronounced sturm, or maybe room was pronounced rom. So rom and storm, they have a higher degree of rhyming that they have nowadays. The difficulty of this unit is that all the poems are in their original form. So you'll read, you'll start reading one of these poems, and the poem is rhyming perfectly, and all of a sudden the rhyming breaks down and you really don't understand what's going on. Probably it has to do with this, with a pronunciation that has shifted over time. Very, very common in American English, by the way. Okay, so it should be unsurprising. The stanzas, which are a group of lines of verses, the stanzas are normally divided into, classified according to the number of lines that they have. A couplet is a stanza formed by two lines that generally rhyme and have the same length. So we would have a couplet of iambic pentameters, two lines that are pentameters and they rhyme. A tercet would be three together. A quatrain, four. In English Renaissance poetry, couplets and quatrains are the overall standard. They are much more frequent than the rest.
Okay, so when we read the introduction to the poem, we're going to say, this poem is an iambic pentameter, the lines are divided into couplets. So you know immediately that every two verses you're going to have a rhyme. That is the first analysis that you should have if you had to analyze Anne Bradstreet in a peck or in an exam. The sextet would be a six-line stanza. An octave or an octet would be an eight-line stanza. Okay, and to understand all of these ideas, like the extended metaphor, the pun, the tone, the verbal irony, we'll get to it little by little as we read the poems. And if you have any doubts on any of them, for example, extended metaphor is a metaphor that occupies the entire poem. You can read about all of these in the glossary. That's why I say that the study guide is not an optional book. I think it's a book that you really need to have. And if you don't have one and you can't put, you can't find it because it's not available in the store or whatever, pick one up at the library because there's a ton of them. So don't let them go to waste. I'm going to place on the screen, I think it's slide number 7 or slide number 8, the first poem that we read. No, it's number 8. Or even number 9. The author to her book, and I'm going to read it from the book, so I can give you... Oh, it's number 9. My God, so much information in these slides. I have to simplify them a bit. I'm going to read from the book. I see that some of you are having problems in the chat. Nobody's written a message in a very long time. That normally means that you can hear me, but you can't see me, or you have some connection problems. If somebody can write the message, that would be really cool. But if I have a connection problem, you're probably not going to be able. I'm not going to be able to read it. I'll just wait to see if anybody writes anything in the connection is fine. Great. So I guess it's just a case of whoever's having a problem. It's their particular internet connection. Thank you, Julio, Patricio, another Patricio, no? Yeah. My God, it's not such a common name, no? So this is a Patrick class. I'm expecting an invitation to beer on St. Patrick's. I don't know if I'm asking for too much. I don't know how that works in quarantine. Okay, so we're going to read the author to her book. Great. Thank you very much for the feedback. It's very, very useful. Regarding the author to her book, on page 45 of the textbook, you have a very interesting presentation that I'm going to mainly skip for the sake of brevity and to be able to read all of the poems and give you some thoughts on them. I'm going to only read from Professor Gibert's great analysis, the last paragraph of her analysis before the poem, because it gives you a lot of information. The poem is written in heroic couplets. Remember, they're also called rhyming couplets. That means they receive that name of heroic, or rhyming means two by two. Because they rhyme on consecutive lines in pair AA, BB, CC, DD. The meter, the fixed arrangement of accented and unaccented syllables, may seem irrelevant to many modern readers, but it was extremely important for many centuries, and any appreciation of poetry should consider at least the basic principles of meter and its relationship to rhythm, the sense of movement communicated by a metrical pattern. Nowadays, one of the poetic geniuses of the world of universal literature is Emily Dickinson. In her time, however, Emily Dickinson was considered to be a flawed poet. She never published in her lifetime. One of the reasons she never published in her lifetime is that she abandoned intentionally rhyme and meter. And that was so badly considered in her time that they just thought that she wasn't talented enough to be able to abide to rhyme and to meter. So that just goes to show how important the public perception of your work is as much as the overall quality, because many works don't receive the appreciation of their time just because the audience is not prepared for the type of work that you're writing. Obviously, if Emily Dickinson is still so relevant, it's because she was way ahead of her time. So there is a mixed pattern of meter, a unit called a foot, which in the case of the following poem is formed by an unstressed syllable followed by a stressed syllable, defeat. This is a metric pattern known as iambic, which is the most common pattern in English poetry. Since each metrical line of this poem has 10 syllables and each foot has 2 syllables, each line has 5 feet. A line of verse consisting of 5 feet is called a pentameter. Therefore, regarding the form, the following lines are rhymed iambic pentameters. Balance and control are the main characteristic of the heroic couplets below. Let me check very quickly if I have recordings of the poems, because I think that a nicer voice than mine can illustrate better the poems. Oh, I don't have an internet connection, and that would take me a bit of time to set it up. So I'll do that for the next poet that we have, for Phyllis Wheatley or whatever, and I'll just read these poems. Sorry about that, because I don't have such a good voice, and these readers are very interesting to hear. The first poem is called The Author to Her Book. Let me start. Though ill-formed offspring of my feeble brain, who after birth didst by my side remain, till stats from thence by friends less wise than true, who thee abroad exposed to public view, made thee in rags halting to the press to trudge, where errors were not lessened, all may judge. At my return, my blushing was not small. My rambling brat in print should mother call. I cast thee by as one unfit for light. Thy visage was so irksome in my sight. Yet being my own, at length affection would thy blemishes amend if so I could. I washed thy face, but more defects I saw, and rubbing off a spot still made a flaw. I stretched thy joints to make thee even feet, yet still thou runnest more hobbling than is meet. In better dress to trim thee was my mind, but not save homespun cloth in the house I find. In this array, monks vulgar, may thou roam, in critic's hand, beware thou dost not come, and take thy way where yet thou art not known. If for thy father ask, say thou hadst none, and for thy mother she, alas, is poor, which caused her thus to send thee out the door. So as you can see, there is a tongue-in-cheek sort of poem where she's talking about the defects of her poems, but at the same time how she affectionately has a very close regard for her poems, how foolish her brother-in-law had been for publishing them initially, even though she extends the version and adds more. It's all a fake front. She's trying to deprecate intentionally, and that is another element that is very common in female writers. Self-deprecation. They reduce the importance of their work because they are afraid of offending men. Offending other Puritans, but basically offending other men. Of surpassing the expectations that women should have in her time. So those are the ideas that you should take into consideration. When, for example, in line 15, I stretch thy joints to make thee even feet. The joints of a person are the knees, the elbows, the shoulders, the thigh. The joints of a poem are the verses. So stretching the joints means like lengthening them to make them even, to make them rhyme, and to make them have the same amount of feet. So that's why she says to make the even feet. So there's a pun. There's a very, very intentional pun there. I think that's one of the those are some of the details that you should walk away with from this poem. If you take into consideration the exploratory questions, you can see that an extended metaphor is a metaphor that goes over the entire poem. In this poem, we have an apostrophe. I told you about that, how the apostrophe is treating something that is not human as if it were human. She's treating the poems as if they were the book entirely, and the verses as if they were her children. And in the same way, she uses an extended metaphor to refer to the book as a flawed, imperfect thing that is as much as she could come together with, and she's sort of apologetic, but at the same time, the book is called with a certain amount of wit. So there is a huge paradox between what's written on the cover and the poem that introduces the rest of the book. So that's intentional, but at the same time, it's interesting. Another way of calling a pun is paronomasia. A pun is just a play of words, okay? You have that in exploratory question number 2. Interesting poem, to my dear and loving husband, the next one. Oh, so exhausting to speak under a face mask all the time. To my dear and loving husband is written to Simon Bradstreet and is an account and a witness of their happy marriage and how much she loves her husband so openly that she celebrates it in a poem that is intended to be read by her family, but that ends up being a worldwide phenomena of the time and is open to everybody, Puritan or not, that has access to the poem. There is an unusual a sense of desire and even of carnal passion in this poem implicitly that is very, very far from following Puritan principles. But at the same time, loving the family is the purpose of women inside a Puritan family. So she can at the same time say that it is her moral duty as a Puritan to be loving and to be prepared, to be the best wife possible for her husband, and to be the best mother possible for her children. So being affectionate and even passionate about her love is at the same time non-Puritan and Puritan in equal ways. So it's one of these paradoxes that are sort of impossible to come to terms with. So she has an excuse at the same time as she can be criticized for that fact. I think this poem is very, very nice, and it's very, very short. It's a 12-line poem. The meter is rhymed iambic pentameters. I already told you you're going to get used to these to this terminology because it's very repetitive. And the 12 lines rhyme in pairs, so they're couplets, okay? Heroic couplets or rhyme couplets. The poem is formed by 6 rhyme couplets. To my dear and loving husband, if ever too, these are the lines that I chose as a quote for the beginning of the presentation. If ever two were one, then surely we. If ever man were loved by wife, then thee. If ever wife was happy in a man, compare with me, your woman, if you can. It's a challenging verse, very strange for a Puritan wife, like saying, I'm the envy of all of you. And at the same time, every wife has the same feeling towards her husband. That would make a perfect Puritan community. I prize thy love more than whole mines of gold or all the riches that the East does hold. My love is such that rivers cannot quench, nor aught but love from thee give recompense. There's a pararhyme there. It's not an exact rhyme. Thy love is such I can no way repay. The heavens reward thee manifold, I pray. Then while we live in love, let's so persevere that when we live no more, we may live ever. So my opinion is that probably in that there's a change in the pronunciation of either one of the words or both. So probably it's persever and ever. That would make it a more sound rhyme. But since we don't have very good recordings of the 17th century, it's very difficult to know exactly the way it was pronounced. We can just come to conclusions. It's very interesting the metaphor that she uses. It says, "My love is such that rivers cannot quench." Quench is to satiate your thirst. So she compares love to a flow of to the flow of a river, and she says it's impossible to quench. So her love is infinite. It's everlasting and unstoppable. And she says that she feels that she cannot recompense him for how much love she gives and receives. And she just prays to the heaven that he receives the rewards in heaven of all the love that she feels. So it's a very nice and endearing poem. And at the same time, it's contradicting and abiding to Puritan principles at the same time, which is what makes it so difficult. By no means. She's very Puritan. She's a very Puritan woman, and it's just that she's probably being more honest in this poem because this is one of the poems that she was not expecting to be published. This is one of her initial poems. It was published, and then she had to. If you compare this to the previous poem, is much more apologetic, much more restrained. It has a different tone. So there is a big difference between when she speaks her mind, like in these three poems that we're going to read, in places 2, 3, and 4, and when she openly knows that the poems are being read by everybody and she has to give an explanation. So there is a very big difference between what I was saying before, her public voice and her private voice, what she really feels and what she wants everybody to think. So the author to her book can also be a way of apologizing if she crossed any red lines and also trying to say, I am an abiding Puritan person and I do understand. And in this poem, it's going to be very clear how she has this internal conflict of finding something terrible and having like a moment of doubt. And then going back to a moment of absolute faith. This poem provides a clear example of the tension the poet experiences between her domestic concerns and her spiritual aspirations. The speaker, who is once more the poet herself, sadly recalls in detail the prized material possessions she lost in the fire which destroyed her house. Bradstreet dwells on her misfortune for the first 35 lines. So she remains borderline not Puritan for 35 verses of the total amount of 40-something. So for almost three-quarters of the poem, she has a non-Puritan point of view, or at least non-Puritan thoughts and a way of showing herself as also human and also fallible and also full of sin and therefore still unprepared for going to heaven and still in the need of purification, which was one of the obsessions of Puritans. Puritans were on the world to pay for their sins and to perfect themselves to the point where they were worthy of going to heaven. That was their only mission. They had no free will. Everything was previously pre-thought and predestined by God. And therefore, she had no way of being a good Puritan rather than accepting her sins and trying to improve herself over the course of her life. That would be the typical path of a Puritan. With all the Puritans.
Yes, because that's worrying about how Puritans
just wait and see. Yeah. This only gets worse. So Puritan doubts whether they're being worthy of the covenant. The covenant is their agreement with God. Is going to be the eternal conflict that Puritans have. The Puritans that arrive to America have the feeling that they're not being Puritan enough. Imagine when they have children that are already born on American soil and that have no understanding of what is that Church of England, or what is England for any matter. I don't care. I live here. I have no interest in that place. I might not have so much interest as you have in religion and all of that building of perfection that they strive to build. They see how it collapses. And in the 17th century, we're going to go over the Great Awakening, an attempt to re-spiritualize Puritan America. Terribly unsuccessful, but very important in American literature and in American history. So it's something that we're going to definitely see when we reach units 5 and 6, Jonathan Edwards. So going back, in this poem, rhyming couplets are also formed by iambs, but each line has 8 syllables instead of 10 syllables. So we have tetrameters, rhymed iambic tetrameters, okay? Let me read, because this one is long. It's 54 verses. As you can see, there's a significant effort to make everything rhyme. In silent night, when rest I took, for sorrow near, I did not look. As you can see, the rhythm is completely different. It sounds like children's poetry. If you've ever read children's poetry, it sounds very similar. So the tetrameter has a different ring when you read it. It sounds more direct, and it sounds like something that even a child would understand. I wakened was with thundering ring noise and pitch's shriek of dreadful voice. That fearful sound of fire and fire, let no man know is my desire. I starting up the light despy, and to my God my heart did cry, and to strengthen me in my distress, and not to leave me succorless. Then coming out beheld a space, the flame consumed my dwelling place, and when I could no longer look, I blessed his name that gave and took, that lay my goods now in the dust. Yeah, so it was, and so 'twas just. It was his own, it was not mine. Far be it that I should repine. So there she has a moment of weakness where she's worried about everything that is being destroyed. And then she goes back to God and says, it's God's will to give and take. So I cannot say anything about it. He might have all justly bereft, but yet sufficient for us left. When by ruins oft I passed, my sorrowing eyes aside did cast, and here and there the places spy, where oft I sat and long did lie. Here stood that trunk, and there that chest. As you can see, there's a caesura in the middle of that line. There lay that store I counted best. My pleasant things in ashes lie, and them behold no more shall I. Under thy roof no guest shall sit, nor at thy table eat a bit. No pleasant tale shall e'er be told, nor things recounted done of old. No candle e'er shall shine in thee, nor bridegroom's voice e'er heard shall be. In silence ever shalt thou lie, adieu, adieu, all's vanity. So from that moment on, up to 35, it's an account of the tragedy. From that moment on, she looks to the future, and she looks towards her role as a Puritan follower, a Puritan woman, and how she has to accept that her heaven is a paradise that is much more important than anything on earth. There is an incredible shift. She suddenly waves everything goodbye. Adieu, adieu, all's vanity. Then straight I gin my heart to chide, and didst thy wealth on earth abide, didst fix thy hope on mouldering dust, the arm of flesh did make thy trust, raise up thy thoughts above the sky, that dunghill misc away may fly. Thou hast an house on high erect, framed by that mighty architect. So saying, God has a better house for you in heaven than the one you're crying about here in on earth. With glory richly furnished, stands permanent, though this too be fled. So you can imagine that 45 is probably furnished. It's purchased and paid for too by him who has enough to do. A price so vast as is unknown, yet by his gift is made thine own. There's wealth enough, I need no more. Farewell my pelf, farewell my store. The world no longer let me love. My hope and treasure lies above. So she's telling herself, stop crying about a stupid house. Everything that is important for you awaits in heaven. No matter how much you've lost, everything that is still to come is more important. I'm going to read the last poem. I hope I don't get expelled by UNED for doing that. It's a 12-verse poem. I'm not going to be able to go very much into detail. And the poem reads as follow. On my dear grandchild, Simon Bradstreet, page 56, who died on 16th of November, 1669, being but a month and one day old. You can imagine how cruel that passage of her life was. No sooner came, but gone and fallen asleep. So in one line, she narrates the birth and the death of her grandchild. Acquaintance short, yet parting caused us weep. Three flowers, two scarcely blown, and last in thy bud. It's like explaining how brief his life had been. Cropped by the almighty hand, yet is he good. He says, it's God will. I cannot question him. With dreadful awe before him, let's be mute. Such was his will, but why, let's not dispute. With humble hearts and mouth put in the dust, let's say he's merciful as well as just. He will return and make up all our losses and smile again after our bitter crosses. Go, pretty babe, go rest with sisters twain. Among the blessed and endless joys remain. Okay, so that's the end of the last lines. It's probably because of your screen. I don't know how to fix that, Jose Antonio. Afterwards in the recording, it should be available. Okay, I can only tell you that. You have it on page 56 of the textbook, in any case. Thank you very much. I'm running out of battery here. Have a great week. Next week, we'll talk about Mary Rowlandson and the first uniquely American genre, captivity narrative. Okay, so have a fantastic week. Thanks a lot. See you, Veronica. Bye, Julio. Thanks a lot for coming, guys. Okay, it's really important for me.